America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot going on in the news today, an awful lot happening in the world. For example, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has said he's going to free 15 detained British soldiers and Marines as a gift to the British people, to quote the Associated Press. Meanwhile, we seem to be sponsoring a group out of Pakistan that is in Iran killing Iranians. I wonder how we would respond if, say, a group from Mexico was doing that, killing U.S. diplomats inside the United States. Somehow I doubt it would go over very well. And the new issue of Vanity Fair is coming out. The cover story, Leonardo DiCaprio quoting some guy named Tom Hartman in the new issue of Vanity Fair. We'll get to those and a whole bunch of other things going on in the day, Barack Obama's fundraising and whatnot, in a few minutes. But first, New Century Financial Corporation has just declared bankruptcy. This was the largest company in the United States offering subprime mortgages. And you know, basically now they're saying, sorry, Charlie, we're out of the business. And it could be the beginning of something very large, or it might be stemmed right where it is. If it's the beginning of something very large, it could make the SNL bailout of the Bush senior administration, $500 billion bailout, look like chicken feed. That bailout, which benefited, among other people, Neil Bush, one of George Herbert Walker's sons. Yaron Brook is with us from the Ayn Rand Institute. He's the executive director, Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org, the website, the Ayn Rand Institute, the proponents of objectivism, the philosophical base, which in some ways, some portions of objectivism have been borrowed to create what I call Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid, that is libertarians, and also a large chunk of the modern conservative movement Republican Party, the Grover Norquist chunk, although I know, Yaron, that you would disavow all of them because they are not ideologically pure.
Absolutely.
So, Yaron Brook, glad to have you with us. I think it's very, very useful for our listeners to hear the thoughts of the thinkers behind the thinkers. Your take on the bankruptcy of this... In the bankruptcy of New Century Financial Corp.
Well, I think what we're seeing is the market taking care of some bad loans that were issued across the entire subprime market. Bad loans were issued. They can't sell these loans now. The market is rejecting them. And as a consequence, this is not the first, but one among several subprime mortgage lenders that are going bust because people can't pay their mortgages to them.
Yeah, but there's also the human dimension of this. You have families all over the United States, an estimated 2 million right now, who are in default or on the verge of defaulting on their home mortgages because they were hustled into buying subprime mortgages that were really more than they could have afford, or that had gotcha, you know, escalators down the line, and the salesperson gave them a whole song and dance about, oh, don't worry, you know, the value of your house is going to go up so much, we'll be able to refinance and get you another 3-year introductory rate of 4.5%, and now all of a sudden they're paying 6, 8, 10, 12%, which they had never expected. They didn't, you know, it might have been in the fine print, but it wasn't the sales pitch given to them. I would submit to you that this is a problem of a failure of regulation.
Well, two issues here. One is we have to remember who has encouraged for decades, really since the 1960s at least, who has encouraged these subprime mortgages to exist and to promote these mortgages to the poor in America.
Pardon me interrupting you, Yaron. Let's just define for our listeners what subprime is, because it just occurred to me we've been having this conversation and I never defined the term.
Subprime are risky mortgages. They are mortgages given to people who typically would not qualify for prime mortgages. Prime mortgages are regular mortgages. So these are people with high risk, low credit rating, and therefore subprime means risky. Means the likelihood that the mortgage will default is relatively high. And as a consequence, there's a trade-off in finance between risk and return. The higher the risk, the higher the payment you have to make, because the likelihood that you will default on that payment is high. Therefore, you have to make large payments to compensate the lender for that risk of default. It's standard in finance. This is true of municipal bonds or government bonds as much as it is true of mortgages. The higher the risk, the higher the amount of interest you have to pay.
But that's not how it worked. I mean, what we saw with New Century Financial and many of these other lenders is that they said to people, oh, for the first 3 or 4 years, you're only going to have to pay a fixed rate of 3.4%. And then, by the way, it might go up. And
so from
the point of view of the consumer, they're getting a low-rate mortgage, even though they've got lousy credit. And the credit companies realized that there was this danger down the road, but they were looking at one-year financial sheets or two-year financial sheets. They figured they'd make the money and run, and they have. I'm sure that the CEO of New Century Financial has made out very, very well, thank you very much.
Sure, and as a consequence of these subprime mortgages, tens of millions of people have homes that wouldn't have homes if they didn't have. It's true that
and a good chunk of them may lose
them. Two million on the verge of default, but you know very well that there are many, many, many more millions who wouldn't have a home today if this market didn't exist. This market is incredibly healthy if what you want to promote is home ownership. And indeed, the reason the subprime market exists is because government has been encouraging its existence. It's been encouraging the existence through the creation of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, through subsidizing those two entities basically with government-backed insurance. This is why you talked about a government bailout. The only way a government bailout would happen is through Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. This country has liabilities in the trillions to Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae that are off the books, in order to encourage low-income people to own their homes. Now, why do
we want
them to own their homes? Is there value to them owning their homes? It's very dubious, but that is government policy. It's government policy going back to many Democratic administrations as well as Republican administrations, and it's a bad policy. Government should not be encouraging people to own or not own a home one way or another. It should be an individual decision based on financial your own financial situation, and sometimes it makes more sense to rent than to own.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with you on that
point.
But we have
government policy driving this. That's the government policy is driving the existence
absolutely
of this market.
Right. And the major part of government policy that's driving it, frankly, is tax policy, and that is that you can write off the interest that you pay on
that's
mortgages.
That's part of it, but remember that low-income people don't really pay the taxes. The people who pay the taxes, that's true of the middle class. But the subprime market, the subprime market that is targeted to people who don't pay taxes and who don't really get the benefits.
Now, a lot of people in the subprime market are people who are making $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year, and they just have a lot of credit card debt, or they're young.
Who gets the greatest benefit out of the tax policy? The greatest benefit out of the tax policy are people like me who have a large mortgage and make a lot of money and therefore could get a huge deduction.
That's a whole other discussion, but let's get back to the point here.
The taxes is very low. The real way in which we encourage homeownership among the poor through government policy is through the implicit support of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the insurance that we provide for that.
And if we're going to do that, and this is where you and I pause for just a minute, please. This is where you and I are separating, and we've got about a minute and a half here, and I'd like to be able to just make this point and have you respond to it. I'm suggesting that it's an okay thing if we, the people, decide that we want to promote home ownership. I think, however, if we do that, if we're going to distort that market, which we both agree is happening in that way, then we have to do so in a responsible fashion. That is, we have to say to lenders, sorry, if you're going to make a subprime mortgage that's going to end up being 11%, it should start out at 11% so people know what they're getting into in the beginning. This whole idea of adjustable rate mortgages, for example, should change or should not be allowed, frankly. On the other hand, you would say the government shouldn't be involved in lending decisions or regulating of banking whatsoever, period, at all. Do I have this right?
Two things. One, people should take personal responsibility for figuring out what kind of mortgage they're taking on. It's nobody's business.
But how do they do that when they're not mortgage experts?
What kind of mortgage I take on? They should read the fine print. They should get educated. Otherwise, don't take a mortgage. And second, if you regulate the subprime market, what you'll do is drive away any kind of innovation. That innovation is exactly what has made home ownership possible. The millions of people who own homes today who couldn't otherwise do it only do so because
of the innovation. But just a minute ago, you were decrying home ownership.
Regulation would have destroyed it.
But just a second ago, you were saying home ownership wasn't a desirable thing.
Well, I don't think it is. I don't think government should get involved in that at all. I don't think it should regulate it. I don't think we, the people, have any kind of right to dictate to the market who should own a home and who shouldn't own a home.
Do you think New Century should have the right to declare bankruptcy?
Oh, absolutely. Any business, you treat.
So you think that a business should have the protection of government. They should have the right to declare bankruptcy, but the way that they conduct their business that leads to that bankruptcy should not be regulated.
Absolutely, but I don't think bankruptcy is a way to protect them, the government protection. I think it's a contractual issue.
Okay. Yaron Brook, Executive Director of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND, if you want to read more about it. Yaron, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. We'll be right back.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Have you ever got a note from your bank saying,
"Greetings, your account just shrank by 25 or 30 bucks. Sorry, friend, you're out of luck. You bounced a check. That's what it was. It happens to the best of us. Please cover it quick."
And when you do, you find you got another one or two.
Because what they done, never seen it fail. They notified you by the U.S. mail. Cost them almost 40 cents, but more than worth that little expense. Because by the time you receive that letter, their situation got even better. Your first overdraft cost a couple more. Now you own the pile of money for sure.
They hope you never wonder in your little head why they don't send you an email instead. A quicker way and cheaper, too, for them as well as the customer, you.
Or an automated call to your phone or pager would be an improvement vastly major, but they'd lose all those overdraft fees they charge you. A profit center very large. You see, that's what they call it. The banks charge you two or three times and then say,
"Thanks for making us rich at your expense. Thank God you haven't got the sense to ask us, please, won't you install the software that'll place a call or send an email to let you know."
Because, friends, that's how we make our dough.
There you go. 22 minutes past the hour. Thanks to Jim Turr for that over at BlueCanyonSatire.com. Well, yeah, this raises the whole issue of, actually the whole range of issues that have to do with to what extent is a absolutely unregulated free market desirable in a society where we don't all know each other. See, the libertarian notion that government should not involve itself in business at all rests on the assumption that people will eventually figure out when there's a bad product or when there's bad people or when they're doing bad things or if there's an incompetent doctor, et cetera. People will figure that out. Word will travel around, and that company or those people will lose customers and eventually go away. The problem with that is that it works just fine if you're talking about a community of 200 people out in the middle of nowhere. Or even a few thousand. I used to live in Montpelier, Vermont, a town of around 8,900 people. And there was a doctor in town who was doing eye surgery, and he screwed up a couple of people's eyes. As I recall, he had a drinking or a drug problem, something like that. I don't remember all the details of it. But it did happen when I was living there. And, word traveled around town. And by the time the medical board got to shutting the guy down, pretty much everybody in town knew, "Don't go to this guy." Although he was still able to reel a few in. But if he goes to New York City, is the word going to travel? I don't think so. So when our society starts getting larger than 200 or 300 people in town, larger than, a functional gossip network for all practical purposes, then the restaurant that has cockroaches in the kitchen, or the doctor who is incompetent, or the mortgage lender who is telling you one thing and having you sign a 14-page fine print document that says something quite different, or the for that matter, the siding or window salesman for your house doing the same thing, all of those things take on a whole different dimension. At that point, we as a society need to, in my opinion, and this is, where liberals separate themselves from conservatives. Conservatives would say, "Well, tough, caveat emptor, it's up to you. Let the buyer beware. You need to educate yourself. Go take a college course on how mortgages work. Learn how to, you know, become a lawyer so that you can read all that fine print and understand what it says. Know that there's a difference between the or and the and in the third sentence in paragraph 16 in the fine print on page 9 of that contract. And I would say, you know, we can't expect that of everybody in our society. And so there's a point where we all get together and say, you know, there are some things, there's some kinds of behavior that we actually are going to protect ourselves from. There are some industries that we actually are going to regulate. And if we decide as a society that we think that home ownership is a high value, for example, and so we skew our tax laws in favor of that so people want to buy their home and own their home, and we're going to allow the banking industry to offer mortgages on homes, or a set of it, you know, the mortgage industry, then I think it's entirely appropriate that we say, here's the rules of the game, guys. You can't do this in a way that takes advantage of people who, and I realize to say who don't know any better sounds like a paternalistic statement, but I really don't mean it in that context. Life is just too complicated these days. There's too much flying by. People are too busy. People, you know, with the death of the middle class here ever since Reagan, people working 2-3 jobs. They don't have time to read a 16-page contract, discuss it with somebody who really knows what's going on. They just don't have time. And then into this comes things like, you know, now there's, you buy malt liquor, 12% alcohol, less than a buck, comes in a bottle the size of nail polish, complete with caffeine. These are the new drink. In fact, a promotional site for these products. Spikes adds a unique flavor to beer or beverage of choice and is infused with caffeine, ginseng, and guarana. It's fun with an edge. Yeah. This is 75 cents this stuff costs. 75 cents to a dollar. You can slip it in the smallest clutch purse or tuxedo pocket. Just perfect for your prom date, right? I mean, it's not marketed that way, but in my mind, it's implicit. Mango, lime, melon, chocolate. Come on. Should we, at what point do we say enough already? There's some things that we're going to, some behaviors, some corporate and business behaviors we're going to allow in the marketplace, and others we're not. And we have no problem saying, yeah, if you want to call that a nanny state, go ahead. But we're really interested at the end of the day in making sure that people can live in the society in a way, peacefully in the society in a way that they don't have to be looking over their shoulder at every predator coming down the street. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
They say that Richard Corey owns one half of this whole town with political connections to spread his wealth around. Born into society, a banker's only child, he had everything a man could want, power, great style.
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Listener-supported radio. Indeed, it's supported by you, our listeners, letting our sponsors know, particularly the sponsors on the local radio station that you're listening to, that you're listening to the program, that you will consider purchasing their products or recommending them to others, if you know, you can say so in good conscience. And if not, find sponsors that you think should be on the radio station and let them know, hey, you should be advertising on this station. As well as our national sponsors, of course, SacredGroundsCoffee.com, SmallDog.com, Small Dog Electronics, the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, and Purina One Natural Blends, 866-380-MEOW, M-E-O-W. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, toll-free nationwide, and TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com for our blog, and we will also soon, hopefully soon, have a link to our chat room from AirAmerica.com as well. Lisa in Wisconsin. Hey, Lisa, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Good morning.
Thanks for
afternoon.
Taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, afternoon, morning.
I wanted to
make a comment. I am a mortgage broker, and talking about these subprime mortgages, mm-hmm. most of the customers that come to me that are in the subprime category usually are there because they've either lost their job, lost overtime, or have medical collections. And so the problem with that is that they end up going into these loans thinking, well, I need a lower rate. I need a lower rate no matter what I have to do. I need a lower rate. I need a lower payment. And then they get into these programs, and their bills continue. And, you know, it's just a never-ending cycle.
Right, particularly when it's an adjustable rate mortgage or it's an introductory offer, an introductory special where you get a low rate for a year or 2 years or 3 years or even 4 or 5 years, and then
Right. Boom,
it skyrockets up. And they've figured that by that 4 or 5 years, they'll get their finances under control, or they'll be able to resell the house for twice as much, or a lot of people just have such a lousy sense of time that they can't even imagine that 5 years out is going to happen.
Right. They think, well, you know, in a year my credit will be better, this, that, and the other. But meanwhile, the bills keep piling up, and they're putting more on their credit cards, and in a year they're refinancing again.
Right.
They're paying huge prepayment penalties.
And in that regard, Yaron, actually, one of the few things that Yaron and I have ever agreed on is that, you know, a lot of people should really seriously think about renting instead of trying to buy with a subprime mortgage, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you, Lisa, thanks a lot for the call.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for the heads up on that. Good to hear from you. John in Hackensack, New Jersey. Hey, John.
Yes.
Yes, sir. John?
Yes.
You are live on the air.
Oh, okay. Yes, this problem with the subprime lending probably is connected to 1% of the population owning 99% of the wealth. I mean, how can that be fair if you have, like, 1% controlling all of the whole pie, you know? So
First of all, your number is slightly exaggerated. I think that, you know, you have 1% controlling about 40% of the wealth, and the top 10% owns wealth equal to a little over 60% of all wealth. But nonetheless, your point is well taken. Really, what's going on here, though, is business practices. This is my concern, is that it's not about who owns the wealth. It's about what the business practices are. And the argument that is being played out, and it's going to be played out very soon in Congress, which is why I think this is a very timely discussion, is whether or not government should play a role in regulating the market. And I frankly think that the answer is absolutely, particularly if we're going to subsidize the market by tax policies that give tax breaks to people who have mortgages, for example. Lonnie in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Lonnie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. That goes right to my point, is that I think this whole thing is not an accident. I think it is. You're right. It's about wiping out the middle class, because I help people with tax problems for a living, and I can't tell you the number of people that have come to me, got into a house. Their house gets foreclosed, and even after they deduct the basis of their house, they end up with a gain that's taxable. So not only have they been foreclosed on, they now owe the government $30,000 that they can't negotiate out on because their income's too high and they make too much money to work in those programs. And I think it is really to balance this out, which I don't think is going to happen, we really need to restructure the tax. I mean, if these companies, this guy gets out of bankruptcy, the man who, as you rightly said, probably made millions of dollars off of all these subprime lending loans, even though his company's in foreclosure, I wonder what his tax rates are. And I think it is really a concerted effort to keep the middle class even a little bit lower and to stop the rise and the balance of what really is democracy about.
Yeah. Well, I don't quite see it as such a conspiracy theory, Lonnie, but I do see it as the result of a lack of regulation in the market something that was predicted, actually.
I don't know. You know, people use that word a lot these days, conspiracy, but I'm not so sure it's a conscious conspiracy, but I think it is a conscious, like that man that was talking from the Ayn Rand Society. Like, he doesn't really care about how many people, millions of people might get the Black Plague, for example. He's one of those people that would say, you know, they're poor, they got the Black Plague, let them die.
And, well, let's cut Yaron a break when he's not here to defend himself.
Well, but I mean, the whole Ayn Randian idea is about leave government out of it. And I don't, if you want to call that a conspiracy, I mean, we are a country. That
point is well taken, and to the extent that you would say that, you know, there's a conspiracy to bring down what have, at least since the New Deal, been American democratic institutions, arguably we shouldn't call it a conspiracy because it's all right out in front. I agree with you, Lonnie, and I think your point was well made. Thank you very much. Bob in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to say this. kind of goes back to Upton Sinclair, you know, going back to the jungle. I guess you could go back that way, actually go back even further than that. But, you know, Regulation Q was put in basically in the New Deal, and that was set up our savings and loan to create, you know, the middle class and to have our housing industry. Now,
right, and also to protect people so if they put money with a bank, they wouldn't lose it as they did in the Great Depression.
The FDIC and the FSLIC, right. But when we deregulated the banking industry back in the early 80s and Regulation Q was removed, it was because of deregulation that later on led to the big savings and loan $500 billion bailout that you mentioned. Then after that, we re-regulated because of the Housing Resolution Corporation that had to unload all of those assets.
Right, but we only partially re-regulated. We only re-regulated the savings and loan industry, if my recollection is correct.
Well, we basically eliminated the savings and loan banks. If you look around, they pretty much don't exist because of deregulation. But we then were supposedly, after that, required a 20% down payment, you see, on any mortgage because of that. But see, what's happened is now that subprime, because of the K Street, the contributions to our politicians, that's basically what's allowed this subprime deal to exist. But I want to make another point real quick. It's because basically of deregulation that's led to this disaster, Tom. So, yeah. But let me say this. When you're arguing with these libertarians or Ayn Rand people, right, and you were arguing last week, and you were saying that the New Deal basically got us out of the Republican Depression.
Right.
And the fellow made the point that you were arguing with that it was Herbert Hoover that actually started a lot of those programs. Actually, you were both correct, but the argument that needs to be made on the progressive side is that it was Keynesian stimulus. It was actually a lack of stimulus that kept us in the Depression. It was World War II government stimulus spending that got us out of the Depression. Unfortunately, it was war expenditures. It didn't have to
be. Well, to some extent, actually, you know, we entered World War II in, what, 43, was it?
Or 1945.
45. No, that was when we ended it.
Ended it. Oh, we entered 41.
41. Okay, we entered in 41. I mean, we were coming by 39 and 40. We were moving out of the Great Depression. I would say, you know, things were still bad, but I agree with you that the war stimulation helped. But the conservative side says that it's the only variable, it's the only factor, and I would say that there was a whole variety of things there.
Well, but that was the,
and John Maynard Keynes was the guy who made it happen.
Government stimulus, and so it was government stimulus that actually, basically created the middle class in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said, Bob. Dave in Los Angeles. Hey, Dave, just a minute before we've got to take a break.
Oh, I just wanted to make you aware of a news article that's out this morning out of Southern California, Orange County in particular, that they have a crisis with the FAA air traffic controllers. They only have 35 in L.A. 10 are due to retire this year. And how it correlates to your beginning of the conservative revolution with the firing of the PATCO guys back in the 80s.
Oh, yeah. Well, and now, right now, the FAA, you know, the unionized controllers are struggling to maintain their union.
And who would want to get into that profession after knowing what they know, how high stress and how little pay in the union was gone? This is just a start. I think we're going to see this more and more. And to tie it in with the mortgages, you've got a whole group of baby boomers that think they're going to retire off that house. I think this is well planned to keep them working to pay that mortgage when this whole thing comes down.
Yeah, well, it certainly is having that effect. I mean, the death of the middle class is something that is working very, very well, thank you very much, to the advantage of Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush's true base, the millionaires and billionaires among us and the big multinational corporations. We see it, you know, right across the board, whether it's trade, whether it's, you know, tiny, cheap alcoholic drinks, whether it's, you know, subprime mortgage. You could kind of liken it to one of those. More of your calls when we come back in just a moment. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back to the Vast Liberal Conspiracy. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Russ in Denver, Colorado. We got a lot of calls here. Let's try and keep it all tight. I'll try and keep it short. You keep it short. Russ in Denver. Hey, what's up, Russ? Russ? No, Russ. Let's try Ed in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Ed, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, you are the best, let me just tell you that. I've been listening to talk radio before anybody even heard of talk radio. Just as a quick thing on the subprime mortgages. Last year, 20% of the mortgage industry was the subprime mortgages. What's happening now is the free market society is working perfectly. A couple years back, the mortgage industry ran out of customers because everybody that could afford a home, bought a home, has a mortgage. They had to look for new products to keep the customers coming in the door. They figured out the subprime mortgages, and all there's other products associated with these subprime mortgages. What this has done right now is inflated the price of real estate in the last
three years. And it's a dog chasing its tail, because the subprime mortgage market works as long as the real estate market is going up. As soon as the real estate market starts going down, the subprime market falls apart, because people will borrow risky borrowing decisions on the assumption that the value of their house is going to increase, and they'll be able to make it on the back end when they sell the house or flip it again.
Exactly. And what's going to happen now is, they call me an alarmist. This could trigger a depression.
Well, I don't disagree.
I'll tell you what.
No, I do not disagree.
Oh, yeah.
I agree.
Definitely. Because right now, It's the people that have their mortgages, they went out and used the equity in the inflated value of their home to put swimming pools in the backyard and whatnot. Now all of a sudden, if somebody has a job loss or gets sick in the household and they have to sell the house, which is happening right now in Denver, Colorado, there's developments that 90% of the houses are empty because of foreclosures. They're going to have to go out and sell their houses, and guess what? They're not worth what they paid for.
Right, and then their credit is wiped out for the rest of their lives. You spot on, Ed. Mark in Albany, New York. You work for a subprime lender. You want to defend the industry?
Not defend the industry, Tom. I listen to you every day, and I agree with most of what you say. I just think there's a few points that need to be made. I think the 800-pound gorilla in the room that no one's talk about is why people have to go subprime. I mean, I see people's credit reports every day. I work as a wholesale lender through brokers, and 50% of the business I do are people first-time home buyers. So there's not, you know, a lot of the people are first-time home buyers who could otherwise not buy a house. And, you know, I don't hear people calling about certain credit cards that they're charging people 35% that they can't afford. And that's
I'm equally outraged about that, Mark.
The thing is, you know, for 10 years I've been doing this, and I've helped 95% of the people we've helped put in houses and are doing fine. It's almost like the people now coming back and suing the tobacco companies after smoking for 50 years. I mean, I'm a loyal Democrat, and, you know, but I just think I see everyday people who the companies I've worked for have helped out, and usually these loans are presented, Tom, as a Band-Aid loan. Hey,
I understand, but, Mark, my argument, and tell me if they're, you know, try and punch a hole in this, please. My argument is that if somebody's credit is so bad that they represent a different kind of risk pool,
right,
that instead of, and let's say the prevailing rates are 6%, just for purposes of discussion,
right,
and bankers know that in the normal risk pool at 6%, they're going to have some defaults, they're going to have some that are not, and they're going to make a living at that. And
right,
and somebody comes in and they're part of a different risk pool, and the banks really need to make 8% in order to be able to show just a reasonable profit.
Sure.
That they should simply, right up front, say, this mortgage is 8%, rather than saying, this mortgage is 3.5% for the first 3 years and then goes to 11%, knowing that at the end of 6 years, they're going to make their 8%. Because what that's doing is kneecapping people.
Well, you know, the problem is that the customers want, you know, this stated income programs have got everybody into trouble, and that's probably going to be what goes away.
Yeah, these so-called liar loans.
Exactly. The borrowers get to state their income, and, you know, I think that you're right that we've created the crisis with regard to.
So don't you think that the industry should be regulated in a way that if somebody's applying for a mortgage, they actually have to give honest information about what they can afford, and that the industry can't do, essentially what I think is bait and switch?
Yeah, Tom, but I agree with you 100%. I think most of the lenders, subprime lenders, I mean, the thing that no one realizes is the last thing a lender wants to do is foreclose on a house and take it over. the last thing. They lose money every time. So this notion when I hear
although they've you know, like New Century has demonstrated, there's always, you know, I guarantee you the CEO of New Century is not hurting right now, and his company's going bankruptcy.
But I could tell you of 100 people who've lost their jobs with New Century. So, I mean, if the people at the top.
Right, but they're not the ones making the business decisions.
Well,
I have a lot of sympathy for and empathy with you, Mark. I mean, you're a working stiff trying to make a living. God bless you. But there's somebody up at the top who's making the decision about the kind of product that they're going to offer and the kind of outcome. And their worst downside is that their company will declare bankruptcy and they'll walk off with their $100 million a year salary.
Yeah, but Tom, most of those people who are making $100 million a year want to continue to make it. And I think the thing that New Century or any of these companies wanted to go out of business, I just think that there's a lot of people that the subprime market has helped. And you got to remember, 95% of these subprime loans after 2 years have refinanced into prime, have put people into houses that they otherwise would not be able to afford, and has kept the economy going for the last couple of years. So it's a very small fraction. And I'm not making light of the situation, but I think to keep things in perspective, we need to realize that there has been some real positive that the subprime market, subprime banks have done.
I understand, that's a fair point. I understand and I agree with you. And I would submit to you that a large portion of that success in the subprime market has been the function of the fact that housing prices have been going up.
But wouldn't you like to go before Congress, Tom? And I saw that the regulators, and as a Democrat, a loyal Democrat, it bugs me when I start hearing about regulation, because I don't want to see them throw the baby out with the bathwater here, because there's a lot of good people that need help now, especially. But why aren't we talking about why people can't afford their mortgages and why they need to go subprime? Because the economy is not what everyone's saying it is.
Yeah, okay.
So
good
I appreciate
point,
your time, Tom.
I'll give it to you. Yeah, thanks a lot, Mark. You know, well said. The middle class is getting wiped out, so it's ripe pickings. Iran, up next.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
Indeed, in the Darwinian world of ideas, we're at the top of the food chain. 6 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. A bunch of news coming out of the Middle East. Complete with right-wing spin. It's really quite extraordinary. Of course, you know Nancy Pelosi is visiting Syria. In fact, she may well be on her way home by now. But the picture of her in a headscarf is all over the right-wing blogs. Right? Hot air. The right-wing blog over there. To see the most powerful woman in the world having to yield, however slightly, to a misogynist culture's expectation, the campaign commercial practically writes to say, yeah, right. Instapundit. Feminist in America, subservient in Syria. The new editor. This picture disgusts me. What message is Nancy Pelosi trying to send? Are men women equal to men or not? The little green footballs. Pelosi in a hijab. The modern democratic leadership. How quaint. Yeah, and then you go over to thinkprogress.org, and you can see a picture of Laura Bush in, frankly, a far more completely concealing headscarf. In fact, it looks like her entire body is covered up as she's visiting the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, a place I've visited many times, actually. So it's no problem when Laura Bush does it. When she does George Bush when he goes to Saudi Arabia, does he wear running shorts? I mean, come on, you dress appropriate to the occasion. And Laura Bush did it, Nancy Pelosi did it. I mean, if you don't like the standards of the country, don't go. But if you're gonna visit another culture, I mean, you know, in France you can be topless on a beach if you're female. You come to the United States. Doesn't work that way on most beaches. What, the French are supposed to come over here and say, how dare you? This is, you know, so much right-wing spin. And now Mitt Romney says that he's got a secret plan to end the war. Where have we heard this one before? But this isn't the story that concerns me the most. Larry Johnson over at his blog, noquarter.typepad.com, day before yesterday, was blogging about how John McCain and Lindsey Graham created this photo op in Iraq where they had 100 soldiers, 5 aircraft, you know, Black Hawk helicopters, 100 soldiers. They had to sweep an area, clean out a local market. I think they're called souks, a local market. Clean this out, make sure that it was totally safe, put snipers on the roof, go house to house, make sure that nobody even had so much as a slingshot in the area. And then McCain walks around with a bulletproof vest on. They're going to, apparently he has sold the exclusive rights to the B-roll, to the walking around footage to 60 Minutes. And Larry Johnson blogging about how dare two guys who actually have an understanding of what this means, Lindsey Graham and John McCain, both decorated military officers, Lindsey Graham, a JAG officer in the Air Force, John McCain, an officer, a pilot, as I recall, in the Navy, shot down over Vietnam, prisoner of war for 5 years. These guys know what it means on the downside, on the negative side. They know what it means to go to the local commanders and say, we've got a senator, we need you to arrange a photo op. You need to put a couple hundred soldiers in harm's way. You need to take them away from doing things that are important, assuming that we're actually doing something that's important there. You need to take them away from protecting their buddies. You need to take them away from security operations and have them sweep a market so that Lindsey Graham can buy 5 rugs for $5 and brag about it on TV. And there was a lot of TV. And there were people in that market who were selling those things to Lindsey Graham and John McCain. And those people's faces appeared on TV. And those TV shots were not only shown in the United States, they were shown in Iraq. And so now comes this story in the Times of London, Rupert Murdoch's newspaper, the arguably the British equivalent of the New York Times. You can read this on their website, timesonline.co.uk. The headline and the first paragraph are about an unrelated story. Lorry bomb, lorry is the, you know, Britishism for truck. Truck bomb kills children in school. A newborn baby was one of at least 14 children and adults killed when a suicide bomber detonated a lorry laden with explosives close to a primary school in the northern Iraqi city of Kirkuk yesterday. And then they get to the second paragraph. And this, by the way, in my mind, is a classic case of burying the lead. And I'm frankly surprised that more American press has not picked this up. And I would love to see some confirmation of this. Right now, the story I'm telling you, I only have, and you know, if I were a capital J journalist, I would wait until there was a second or third confirmation. But the Times of London is typically a reasonably good news source, so I'm assuming they have more than a single source on this. So, you know, with that caveat, here's the second paragraph of this story. Listen carefully. The latest massacre of Iraqi children came as 21 Shia market workers were ambushed, bound, and shot dead north of the capital. That would be Baghdad. The victims came from the Baghdad market visited the previous day by John McCain, the U.S. presidential candidate, who said that an American security plan in the capital was starting to show signs of progress. So if this story is right, and as I said, I have not seen any American press or media that has picked up on this yet. It is so far, and it only came out, what, 4 hours ago? Or maybe 8 or 9 hours ago. In any case, it's only been out there for James Hitter in Baghdad reporting for the Times of London. If this story is accurate, then what happened, apparently, was that 21 of the people who were in the marketplace. Maybe the guy who sold the five rugs for $5 to Lindsey Graham that Lindsey Graham is bragging about. The 21 of these people who worked in the Shia marketplace that was the safe part of Baghdad where McCain and Graham walked. The 21 of these people were abducted, tied up, shot dead, and their bodies dumped in Baghdad. From that market. Which takes this a whole step beyond Larry Johnson's original horror that the U.S. was putting our soldiers at risk, five aircraft and 100 soldiers at risk, so that John McCain could have a photo op and Lindsey Graham. And now, again, I mean, we I think at our peril as human beings forget that the Iraqis are humans too. Absolutely as human as you and I. They mourn their children, the loss of their children, their brothers and sisters, their mothers and fathers, their friends, the death and destruction of their nation, the fact that they only have 3 hours of electricity a day on a good day, that a third of the country, that two-thirds of the country has no drinkable water. They are as horrified and as pained by those realities as you and I would be. If Mexico had invaded the United States and there were soldiers in every corner and they were kicking in our doors without any provocation, at least in our minds, and going through our things and tearing our house apart, then walking out and say, you can fix your own damn door. Not to mention everything else is all trashed. Killing people. If some of the soldiers had murdered an entire family so they could rape a 15-year-old girl, as happened in Iraq. I mean, these are the stories that become emblematic of what our presence is. Tragically. How would we respond if it was Mexico occupying the United States to save us from an unelected president who was taking away our civil rights? And then some senator from Mexico comes strutting through the streets of one of our cities, along with, you know, Black Hawk helicopters in the sky and 100 Mexican soldiers securing the area. And then we find some Americans don't like that. And they take some of the people out from the, you know, it's I'm torturing the metaphor here, but you get it. Meanwhile, Iran has said they're going to give back the British soldiers. I don't know, maybe they heard our interview with Cy Hirsch yesterday. We'll see how all that plays out. And what Nancy Pelosi is going to bring back from Syria. More on this in just a second, 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
6 of global corporate interest, the Tom Hartman Program, 21 minutes past the hour. An Iranian diplomat who had been kidnapped in Iraq. This guy was in Iraq at the invitation of Iraq, had gone to an Iraqi bank, was walking away, got kidnapped. He was seized, his name is Sharafi. He was seized more than eight, this is from today's New York Times, an article by Alyssa Rubin. Mr. Sharafi was seized more than 8 weeks ago as he emerged from a bank in the middle-class, predominantly Shiite Baghdad neighborhood of Karaba. The Iraqi police stopped a car with four passengers. Now, this is where it gets really interesting. The Iraqi police stopped a car with four passengers that was following the car in which the kidnappers had placed Mr. Sharafi. In other words, the kidnappers got away, but they had a backup car. The four men were taken to the police station. They said they worked for an Iraqi security service, but when pressed, the security services denied that the men worked for them in any official capacity. The four men remain detained in the Ministry of Interior facility, Mr. Zabari said, although he was uncertain who kidnapped the man. Others familiar with the case say they believe those responsible work for the Iraqi intelligence service, which is affiliated with the Central Intelligence Agency. This is the Iranian diplomat Jalal Sharafi, who was the second secretary at Tehran's mission in Baghdad. He was just released. Ahmed Chalabi says this is a curious coincidence. About the same time that the negotiations over the British sailors is happening, and now they're going to be released. But here's where it gets really interesting. Mr. Zabari, the guy who is being quoted here, Hasyar Zabari, is the foreign minister of Iraq. Excuse me, of Iran. Mix, you know, maybe that's what George did originally. He said, "Yeah, let's invade Iran," except he got the last letter. In any case. Hasha Zabari, the foreign minister for Iran, he says, you know, he's frustrated. He's glad to have his one guy back. But Mr. Zabari said he was similarly frustrated by the case of the five Iranians seized by American troops in January. Remember that? This raid in Erbil in northern Iraq where we went in and went into what the Iranians claimed was an embassy. And we kidnapped these five guys. Actually, it was six altogether, the diplomat in Karada, the Baghdad suburb, and the five in Erbil. We kidnapped six Iranians, and because of that, Iran almost refused to come to a meeting in March in Baghdad, which represented five permanent members of the UN Security Council as well as neighboring countries, to try and settle down things in Iraq. I mean, this is like extreme provocation. Well, this goes... You know, and then this leads then back to the story that we touched on briefly yesterday by Patrick Coburn over in the Independent, where he just lays it out. He says a failed American attempt to abduct two senior Iranian security officers on an official visit to northern Iraq was the starting pistol for the crisis that 10 weeks later led to Iranians seizing 15 British sailors and Marines. In other words, what he's saying is that when we captured these five junior Iranian officials, he says, in reality, the U.S. attack had a far more ambitious objective. It was to seize two men at the very heart of the Iranian security establishment. We were going after two guys, Mohammad Jafari, these are the two senior officials, the deputy head of the Iranian National Security Council, and General Minohar Frauzanda, the chief of intelligence of the Iranian National Guard. We thought that they were there, apparently. They were in Kurdistan on an official visit, during which they met with Jalal Talabani, the president of Iraq, and later saw Masoud Barzani, the president of the Kurdistan regional government, at his headquarters in Erbil. And that's who we thought we were. Apparently, we thought we were getting two of the most senior intelligence officers in Iran. But instead, we kidnapped and are still holding five Iranian diplomats. Well, actually six, we just let one of them go. And Coburn is suggesting that that's why the Iranians were looking for some Brits to seize. Well, they're letting them go today. I wonder, and we just let go one of these six Iranians. I'm wondering if the other five are going to be let go. Are we seeing a de-escalation of tension in the region? Is this because the Democrats were elected and Bush is saying, you know, I just can't do it? Is it because the military is pushing back? Is it because the generals are saying, you want to drop 10,000 bombs on Iran? Do it with somebody else's army. Thank you very much. Or is it part of, you know, the tap dance that Bush is doing to lead us to war in Iran? I honestly don't know the answer. But I believe that the speculation, the discussion of this should be something at the very top of our minds and certainly at the top of our media. What is the goal of the Bush administration with regards to Iran? Where do they want to go with Iran? Your thoughts on that right after this, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, 34 minutes past the hour. The Pakistani tribal militant group response. This is from ABC News by Brian Ross and Christopher Isham. I thought Christopher Isham was a musician. Anyhow, a Pakistani tribal militant group responsible for a series of deadly guerrilla raids inside Iran. I have to get my pronunciation right. Inside Iran has been secretly encouraged and advised by American officials since 2005. That would be 2 years if my math is right. U.S. and Pakistani intelligence sources tell ABC News. The group called Jandullah is made up of members of the Baluchi tribe, no relation to John, and operates out of the Baluchistan province in Pakistan, just across the border from Iran. Tribal sources tell ABC News that money for Jandullah is funneled to its youthful leader, Abd el Malik Reji. The guy's name is Reji? It's got to be a British connection in here somewhere. Through Iranian exiles who have connections with European and Gulf states. There you go. There's your European connection. The leader, Reji, claims to have personally executed some of the Iranians. The Jandullah has produced its own video showing Iranian soldiers and border guards it says it has captured and brought back to Pakistan. This is from ABC News. I'm sharing this with you. You can find it over at abcnews.com. Reji is essentially, this is from Alexis DeBott, senior fellow on counterterrorism at the Nixon Center, and an ABC News consultant. The Nixon Center? Can you imagine when it's going to be Joe Blow with the George W. Bush Center, when he's got his $500 million presidential library with all his presidential scholars out there spinning the news? Anyhow, this guy from the Nixon Center, Mr. DeBott, or DeBate, DeBott, I'm assuming, Alexis DeBott. Alexis, maybe it's Ms., I don't know. Anyhow, Reji is essentially commanding a force of several hundred guerrilla fighters that stage attacks across the border into Iran on Iranian military officers, Iranian intelligence officers, kidnapping them and executing them on camera. Now, again, I ask you the question. If Mexico was sending people across the border and they were going to Washington, D.C. and kidnapping and executing people from the U.S. Department of State and the CIA, how would we respond? Or if there was a terrorist group operating out of Mexico with the support of Mexico that was, say, really based in Texas, but Mexico was paying their way, and when they got chased really hard, they retreated to Mexico, how would we respond? Most recently, Jandullah took credit for an attack in February that killed at least 11 members of the Iranian National Guard riding in a bus in the Iranian city of Jihadan. And it goes on. So, let's see. There is a country in the Middle East that is supporting terrorism. These terrorists have captured legal diplomats of a legal country that actually elects most of its leaders and executed them on camera. The country that is supporting that terrorist group? The United States of America. How low are we going to sink? With the so-called leadership from the so-called administration. I mean, this is miserable. Emily in San Francisco, California. Welcome to the program, Emily.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my question. I actually just had a thought regarding the Bush administration's intentions with Iran and this Pakistan report that you're mentioning. I can't really speak to, although I will say that it doesn't surprise me. And I think it's just another indication of why we need to refocus attention on how our institutions work here at home, specifically regarding congressional oversight and the actual war powers the executive has. I think the Iraq resolution that supposedly gave the president authority really just gave him authority to decide on his own what was in the nation's interest. And I think that is at the root of a lot of our problems regarding war policy and foreign affairs.
I agree with you, Emily. And I think that resolution should be revoked. If Cy Hirsch's analysis of that resolution was correct, and David was going to track down a copy of it for me yesterday, we don't have it yet, but he's going to do it in the next 15 minutes. And you know, we'll look at that resolution and check the language of it. But if Cy Hirsch was right, and I have every reason to assume that he was, then Bush has essentially unlimited power as long as he claims to the Congress that it has to do with 9/11. And that unlimited power, I spot on, absolutely agree with you, is something that should be done away with as soon as possible. Earl, driving in Michigan, listening to us on WDTW. Hey, Earl, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Before the break, you posed the question on what we thought the Bush administration's intentions were in Iran. I believe it's clear what their intentions are. If you look at all the parallels in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq, there was a report, I can't find it on Google, perhaps maybe someone on your staff could find it on LexisNexis, but in late 2002, Colin Powell made a public statement that we were going to give it another diplomatic try at Iraq to save off the possibility of going to war in Iraq. And this angered the Bush administration officials, and this was publicly announced in the news that they were angered. Well, they won't even talk with Iran. And I believe that their intentions are clear. They want a military solution to Iran, and unless we figure out a way to stop it, I think it's going to happen, and it's going to be a scary thing.
Yeah, I agree with you. And not only was Colin Powell saying, you know, we're not going to go after Iraq and don't worry and everything's going to be fine and, you know, all that sort of thing. But George W. Bush himself was saying it as well. I mean, it just gets deeper and deeper as you go further and farther into it. Lewis in Manhattan. Hey, Lewis, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I enjoy talking to you, but let me turn the page for a second. The centralization of wealth in the country is being so consolidated. It's like a web being spun around the free enterprise market. You got two world banks eating up small banks. These small banks feed all these small businesses in this country. If we keep getting consolidated like this financially, I mean, what's going to happen to the choices for anything? It's all going to be so centralized, political. And social structures will be dominated by centralized wealth.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you, and that's why I strongly argue on this program that we should return to the Sherman Antitrust Act and begin reinforcing it. Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act in the early 1980s, and that led to what we refer to as the greed is good era, the mergers and acquisition area, where you had all the Michael Milkins and all these guys making fortunes by combining a whole bunch of small and medium-sized companies into one giant one, or for that matter, some very large companies into huge companies, into massive companies, and the consequence of that was, as you say, an enormous consolidation of wealth. Further, that consolidation of wealth is happening within the military-industrial complex, the Carlyle Group leading the charge, and that's not good for American democracy either, in my opinion. I absolutely agree. Charlie in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Charlie, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. I really appreciate that Mexico metaphor you used. People forget that both of our neighbors to the north and south, Mexico and Canada, refused to join in George W.'s excellent adventure in Iraq. Neither one would participate in the quote-unquote coalition of the willing. And you extend this now to this John McCabe and Mincy Graham's excellent adventure in the market, the shopping spree. NPR reported that all the exits and entrances to the market were sealed for their little binge. And the next day, one of the vendors denounced this as propaganda.
Right.
What's going on here is so excrementitious. I don't know what word to use. If you look at the full context of this, a couple of days before, I believe you reported this too, McCain had spouted off that General Petraeus rides around in an unarmed Humvee. And Wolf Blitzer and the other reporter...
Well, in fact, here it is, just for our listeners who don't know, Charlie. Let me just play this clip.
You know, everything we hear, that if you leave the so-called green zone, the international zone, and you go outside of that secure area, relatively speaking, you're in trouble if you're an American.
You know, that's where you ought to catch up on things, Wolf. General Petraeus goes out there almost every day in an unarmed Humvee. I think you ought to catch up. You see, you are giving the old line of 3 months ago.
He goes out in an unarmed Humvee, an unarmed, unarmored Humvee every day.
Note the arrogance and the snappishness, just like Bush, that he did this again about the market. He said, I just came from there. So let's bash the press. Let's lie about how safe it is in Iraq, and at all costs, let's keep it going. You know,
I think this is the end of John McCain's.
ExxonMobil has to keep making what comes out to $4 million an hour in profits. Right. And the report that was on Nightline last night, I believe, is really significant, Tom. This terrorist group operating out of Pakistan into Iran. We forget that the same things went on in the Nixon administration. Nixon's pardon went through. Nobody was really punished. The same group, same cadre showed up in the Reagan administration doing things in El Salvador
Iran
Contra. And now we have these groups, again, the same groups are in the White House.
Yeah, it's the same guy. It's Elliot Abrams. It's Rumsfeld. It's Cheney.
Kissinger.
Kissinger advising Bush right now. Yeah, absolutely, Charlie. Spot on. And you know, when are we going to wake up and say enough already? You know, two generations solidly of corrupt Republicans. Enough. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Get alive, get a grip, get away somewhere, take a trip. Take a break, take control, take advice from someone you know. Oh, come on over, come on in, pull up a seat, take a load off your feet. Come on over, come on in. You can.
It's your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity here at the Tom Hartman Program. On Air America Radio, Victoria Jones with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
What's happening in Washington of note?
Well, this isn't necessarily major of note, but it's an interesting thing. It's the House Armed Services Committee deciding that it's no longer going to use the phrase the global war on terror.
Yeah, I saw that. I thought that was very wise of them.
It is, and it's about time, and it's really groundbreaking because everybody else really does just go along with this. The other phrase, the long war, is being taken out as well. I think people are really just starting to react to this. They haven't quite taken this in, but it's enormously significant and only something that I think would happen under Democratic leadership. It certainly wasn't going to happen under Republican leadership. So that's something that's happening. But it's an odd week. I mean, it's a quiet week because the president's gone to California today, where he'll be giving a speech, and then he heads to Crawford, where he'll have a working weekend.
Right, yeah.
Very hard when he's in Crawford.
I'm sure. Reading Camus?
He's got a lot of brush to clear.
Yes, given that it's a slow week, let me just run something by you here. This is Senate Joint Resolution 23. This is the law that made it possible for Bush to attack somebody. And it says, to authorize the use of United States Armed Forces against those responsible for the recent attacks launched against the United States, whereas on September 11, 2001, acts of treacherous violence were committed against the United States and its citizens, whereas such acts render it both necessary and appropriate for the United States to exercise its right to self-defense, whereas in light of the threat to national security and foreign policy posed by these grave acts of violence, and whereas such acts pose an unusual and extraordinary threat, whereas the President has authority under the Constitution to take action to deter and prevent acts of international terrorism against the United States. Now, therefore, The joint resolution may be cited as the authorization of the use of military force. The president is authorized to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001.
Right.
Now, that's what the war resolution says. And then Bush, on March 21st, 2003, writes a letter to Congress in which he says, "Dear Mr. Speaker, I have determined that the use of armed force against Iraq is consistent with the United States and other countries to take necessary actions against international terrorists and terrorist organizations, including those nations, organizations, or persons who planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001. Now, given that the law that gives him war powers says that he can only attack countries that attacked us on 9/11. And given that his letter to Congress says that he's going after Iraq because they attacked us on 9/11, isn't there some standing, isn't there some position that can and frankly should be taken by Congress to say, sorry, buddy, you need a new authorization if you want to continue fighting this war because you have not demonstrated to us that you told us the truth. And for that matter, if we can find out that you lied, maybe we should think about impeaching you.
It would seem as though he doesn't have very much standing here.
Yeah.
It really would.
So, I mean, might, for example, if he vetoes this resolution that just gave him another $100 billion to fight the war for another, or to maintain the occupation, I've got to correct my own language here, for the next year. Might that be, and he vetoes it, it's thrown back into Congress, might that be a good point for Congress to say, you know, we've got this law that says you can attack somebody who attacked us on 9/11. We know now that Iraq isn't that. And we've got a letter from you saying that Iraq attacked us on 9/11. We know that that isn't that. So we're going to hold some hearings on this before we talk about giving you any more money. You think?
I think so, yes.
Yeah.
So
now all we have to do is convince some members of the House and Senate.
Well,
that we've solved the problem.
Well, and that may not be that difficult.
Yeah. Okay, second question I had. Yeah, another question I had for you, Victoria, this morning when you and I talked about 5 hours ago, or thereabouts, I mentioned to you this story in the Times of London that 21 of the Shia, of the men who work in the market where John McCain took his little stroll a couple days ago, were found dead today, ambushed, bound, and shot dead. And quoting from James Hyder in Baghdad, reporting in the Times, timesonline.com.co.uk, the victims came from the Baghdad market visited the previous day by John McCain, the U.S. presidential candidate. Has this been picked up by any other media? Is there any confirmation of this outside of this correspondent in the UK? In the UK,
I've seen this nowhere, and I have been trawling the media, I must say. Almost to the point where I'm doubting that it even happened.
Well, I'm reading it. I've it's a printout. You go to our chat room. We'll give you the URL to the Times Online. It's timesonline.co.uk. Well, the whole URL would take longer to give to you than you could take it. But
I'm sure if I go to Times Online, I can find it.
Yeah, timesonline.co.uk. So, yeah, that's interesting.
But, yeah,
that's
it's not been picked up by
anywhere.
Nobody.
And this ABC News report that for 2 years we have been funding a terrorist organization in Pakistan that is kidnapping and murdering on videotape civilian members of the Iranian equivalent of their CIA and that sort of thing. ABC reporting this. Is there universal outrage around the world or in Congress about this?
I've heard no outrage. In fact, I've heard earth-shattering silence.
That's extraordinary.
Of course,
you know, a lot of members of Congress are, you know, back home in their districts.
Well, a lot of them are back home in their districts, and quite honestly, they are traveling around, and they're not having vacations. They are working. They're going around their districts, and they're getting an earful. So they probably aren't hearing about it.
Yeah, very interesting. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Victoria, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you.
Good speaking with you. It's 57 minutes past it. Well, we'll see how this shakes out. And if this Times Online story, this story from the London Times, is picked up anywhere else, and if so, how far it gets. Or is this going to be one of those things that falls into the memory hole? Or maybe it didn't happen. We'll find out. 57 minutes past it.
The The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. You know, there are some times when you're pretty sure you know what you know. Sometimes you're pretty sure you don't know. You know what you don't know. Sometimes you're not sure at all of everything you know, and sometimes even everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync and thinks that you're out of your mind. Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be Everything You Know Is Wrong? Our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, by the way, sponsored by TheLiberalStore.com. All things liberal and bumper stickers, buttons, T-shirts, and more. Go check out the liberal teddy bear there now at TheLiberalStore.com with the T-H-E. Daniel Sheehy is with us. He's the author of Fighting Immigration Anarchy. His website, FightingImmigrationAnarchy.com. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
I'm assuming that we could probably agree right at the outset that our political points of view are at opposite ends of the pole.
Well, not necessarily. We agree on a few things. We agree.
Well, that's actually what I want to talk about. But that you would probably characterize yourself as a conservative, and I would certainly characterize myself as a liberal.
Well, I characterize myself as an American who searches for the truth and supports the Constitution.
Well, I'll take that one.
Okay.
I'll take that one. The one of the things that I found most disturbing about your book, Fighting Immigration Anarchy, is the idea that there has been a plan in place going back to the 90s that was participated in by, at the very least, the Reagan-Bush administration, then the Bush senior administration, then the Clinton administration, and is now being moved forward very, very rapidly by the Bush junior administration to economically, if not politically, merge the United States, Canada, and Mexico.
You're absolutely right, and it's not even just a political and economic merger as I've, you know, delved in this further and further every day. It's even a merger of our police and military with both Mexico and Canada. And you're right, this really began a couple of decades ago with Reagan and then with the first President Bush, who pushed NAFTA, which is the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was signed by President Clinton in 1994. And now we have the current President Bush, who has allowed our sovereign nation to be invaded by millions of people here illegally. Since 9/11, we've been told we're in a war on terror, yet this administration and this Congress have allowed millions of people to illegally enter our country, and now we know the reason. And the reason
It's worked tremendously to the benefit of their economic buddies and the people that write them checks. So let's just be honest about this.
Exactly. Absolutely. It benefits the executives at the multinational corporations. It doesn't benefit the middle class. But the reason they're allowing this to happen is they are slowly merging the United States with Mexico and Canada into a North American Union similar to the European Union.
Yeah. Now, Daniel, back in the 60s, I remember reading John Stormer's book, None Dare Call It Treason, and
right.
getting all worried that there was a communist under every desk in the State Department and that they were coming to take us away, haha. And, I mean, there was pretty widespread hysteria in the United States up through that time. There's still some people who are convinced the communist threat is the biggest threat we have to face. And it was widely disproved, frankly. I mean, it turned out to be a conspiracy theory. The Soviet Union was having enough trouble just holding itself together. The CIA back in the early 60s, when they started saying that the Soviet Union had less than 20 years, it was, you know, dying from rot within, turned out to be right, and by and large. And so how do you respond to people who say, oh, another conspiracy theory, another, you know, xenophobic nationalist, these guys are just paranoid?
Well, Well, this is not a conspiracy theory, although it is a conspiracy, but it's not a theory. And the people who, according to my research, who are managing this for the Bush administration are Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, and Carlos Gutierrez, who's head of the Commerce Department. I have numerous reports and documents, Tom, both from the government and also that were obtained by Judicial Watch through a Freedom of Information Request Act, that talk about the various meetings that our so-called leaders are attending, where they are behind closed doors. They are integrating, really, you know, everything from energy to transportation to food, agriculture, and, of course, the
federal government has a website for this, don't they?
Well, they do, although there's not as much information as you might find elsewhere, but certainly there's a website for this. It's really an open secret at this point. And it's interesting. Back in London in 2000, former Soviet dictator Mikhail Gorbachev described the European Union as, quote, the new European Soviet. And I'm wondering, does that mean that the North American Union is going to be the new American Soviet?
Well, I don't know. We're talking about Daniel Sheehy. He's the author of Fighting Immigration Anarchy. Daniel, my position with regard to immigration has been that basically what we're looking at is an economic issue here, that every nation has an obligation to essentially control their borders with regard to what's useful for that nation. And by control their borders, I don't mean put up fences. And I suggest that we don't have an illegal immigration problem in the United States. We have an illegal employer problem. And you know, having worked in other countries where I've had to spend as much as 6 months to get a working visa, I can tell you most countries are pretty zealous about making sure that their workforce doesn't get diluted. And we have been the exact opposite. That said, when I talk, you know, and because some people perceive that to be a, quote, anti-illegal immigrant position, although I wouldn't necessarily characterize it as such, when I talk with folks who are, you know, vigorously anti-illegal immigrant, what I hear so often is language like Michael Chertoff today is quoted as saying that we need to be worried about clean skin terrorists from Europe. In other words, people of light complexion, basically racist language. There's a strong, frankly, you know, frightened, xenophobic, and racist thread that runs through the groups that that show up on Lou Dobbs, you know, that show up saying, oh, we've got to stop immigration, and really what they're saying is that they want to stop, you know, brown people from coming into the United States or stop any kind of a merger between the United States and Mexico. Please address that issue for a moment.
Yes, thank you. My book is mostly about people, Americans of all different backgrounds. I feature a number of people in my book, blacks, including a man down in South Central Los Angeles, not too far from my home, who is suffering because of this massive immigration invasion, a woman who was raised on a Sioux Indian reservation who started the California Coalition for Immigration Reform, people of all different races, ethnicities, skin colors, Jewish, Christian, non-believers, people from different career paths are all featured in my book. And while they have different backgrounds, they all have a love for America. They have a love for our sovereignty and our freedoms and for our quality of life. When you allow millions of people to illegally enter your country or even legally enter your country every single year, they can't assimilate. And Samuel Gompers, who you probably know, head of the American Federation of Labor back in the early 1900s, he condemned the push by greedy employers for more and more immigrants at the expense of American workers.
Well, yeah, that has historically been the progressive position. I mean, all the way back to the 1880s, Cesar Chavez and Walter Mondale marched from the Central Valley of California down to the Mexican border to protest the use of illegal undocumented workers to break the United Farm Workers Union.
Right, right.
This was back in the 1960s. Now, it's become unfashionable since about 2000 when suddenly the unions said, oh, gee, new members. Maybe we won't be so upset about this.
Right.
And I find that the left has just been subsumed in this notion of, you know, why should we have national borders, and or for that matter, state borders? And it seems to me that there's actually some wisdom in this.
Well, you know, between 1924 and 1970, America became a mostly middle-class society, and I know you talk on your program a lot about the middle class, and I thank you for doing so, but during those decades between 24 and 1970, our middle class grew to be the greatest, strongest, largest middle class the world had ever seen, primarily because immigration was significantly reduced by Congress. And as a result, people...
Actually, I would say yes, that was a piece of it. Primarily, it was because trade was limited. We still had the remnants of Smoot-Hawley in place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were not allowing companies to ship their manufacturing offshore.
Well, certainly there were other factors, but this was a primary reason why the middle class grew to be the wonderful middle class that it was during that time period. People at the bottom of the economic ladder saw their wages rise rapidly, and because the immigration stream was reduced, immigrants assimilated into the American society. That's back when we had maybe 150,000, 180,000 legal immigrants coming to America every year. They were able to assimilate. Now we have millions of people pour in, and they're unable to assimilate because of this, the large numbers.
I think we need to raise the level of people who can come in legally and just say, hey, get in line. And particularly, I mean, there are refugees out there who really, you know, for all practical purposes, should be here and can't get here. Daniel Shee, Fighting America, Immigration Anarchy, is website.com. Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Tom Hartman with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Larry Scott's with us with VAWatchdog.org, one of the finest websites on earth for veterans. And hey, Larry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you again. Thanks.
Great to have you. This, the Dole Shalala Commission on Military and VA Healthcare. Please tell me what this is.
Well, the Dole Shalala Commission was founded in the wake of the Walter Reed scandal and all the problems that popped up there. And then after, of course, the Walter Reed scandal hit, a lot of members of the press began looking at VA hospitals. And what they...
You're talking of just a few months ago.
Yes, we're talking in the last 8 to 10 weeks. And what happened from all of that is basically they found there was a tremendous problem transitioning our wounded troops from military health care into VA health care, which are two entirely separate systems. So President Bush formed a wonderful sounding commission. It's called the Presidential Commission on Care for America's Returning Wounded Warriors. It seems like those names are always too long instead of just calling it a commission. And to head that up, we have former Senator Robert Dole and former Secretary of Health and Human Services Donna Shalala. They've named also 7 additional members to the commission. This was welcomed in the veteran community. This was considered one of the best things that could ever happen. Two very powerful people who have a lot of pull in Washington looking into these problems. However, something has come up here in the last few days that is just incredible. First, they haven't even held their first meeting. The first meeting isn't scheduled till the 13th of this month. And they've been given a deadline of June 30th. June 30th means in 2.5 months, Tom, they have to analyze the problems in the military health care system, the VA health care system, how the transitioning is done between those two programs, come up with solutions, and present that to the president. It cannot be done.
Why would they set this up this way?
Well, there are a couple of theories going on here, and you're going to find your major veteran service organizations like the VFW and the DAV, the American Legion, and so forth. They're very, very happy about this, and openly they're saying, this is what we need, this type of commission. Behind closed doors, they are wringing their hands because they know this can't be done in 2.5 months. Their theory is right now that this report has already been written, and it's been written for the commission by any number of people. The number one suspect, of course, is the very conservative think tank, the American Enterprise Institute. If this has any credence, and I do believe it does, that this report has been written and it's already ready to go, this could mean some really bad news for veterans and also our returning troops. It could mean...
They're basically going to recommend the privatization of everything military.
There you go. That's that's what a lot of people fear in the veteran service organizations. They don't want to talk about it now, but they'll talk about it behind closed doors. That basically we have problems in the military. Let's give these guys chits and vouchers and they can go to private doctors. And the VA now is so overcrowded. Of course, the reason it's overcrowded is because it's underfunded. That the same thing. As they transition and become veterans, we'll give them vouchers. We will privatize this health care. If that happens, this will mean a complete dismantling of the VA health care system. That's the worst case scenario, Tom. The best case scenario could be that they just say, well, the programs are in place, they just need better monitoring, which of course leaves us with the same group of problems because there's not enough funding to implement the programs properly. I would look for out of this commission most likely a move in one form or another to privatize some forms of military and veterans health care.
Are the Democrats on this, Larry?
I think there are many that are, actually. And it has to do with budgetary constraints. When I talk with Democratic leaders on Capitol Hill, Tom, I get this kind of answer. Yes, we need to support our veterans. Yes, we need to fund the VA better. But, Larry, where are we going to get the money? How are we going to work within the budget constraints we have? And if you mention the T word, taxes, the subject gets dropped completely. They're not going to go there. So I have a feeling that there would be many Democratic leaders on Capitol Hill who would buy into this under the guise of efficiency for these two systems instead of funding the systems properly.
Well, we just have a few seconds left, Larry. The U.S. to search for GI bodies in North Korea. I was talking with a guy yesterday who told me that he knows of somebody who's actually still missing in Korea.
Yes.
Are there prisoners being held in Korea, American prisoners from the Korean War?
No, we do not know that for sure. What we do know is there were 33,000 Americans killed in Korea. 8,100 are still listed as missing, if you can believe that or not, from the Korean War. Former VA Secretary Anthony Principe, New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson, they're a private delegation, but they're doing this with the approval of the White House. North Korea's opened the doors. What many families think is this could be a first step to the North Koreans saying, yes, we do have remains. You may take these remains home and then use DNA analysis to find out who they are. But there are still 8,100 GIs listed as missing from the Korean conflict, if you can believe that, over 50 years later.
I can believe it. There may be even still some people there. I mean, that's
There could be.
And this could be the opening that could lead to some sort of a thaw in relations, possibly?
I would hope so. It is a marvelous movement, and I would hope that the North Koreans are very open with this delegation.
Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, the website. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you very much, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour. Your call's next, 866-303-2270.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
The votes of me and you, we never would have had these Republican blues. Well, the last 6 years we've been under a curse. It ain't getting better, it's worse and worse. Me and the president, we don't agree. Now the NSA's got a file on me. I've got those blues, Republican blues.
34 minutes past the hour here on the radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States of America. Ted in New York City, welcome to the program. Hey, Ted, what's on your mind?
I was listening to your program, and I could assure the gentleman from the veterans organization that there's no way on earth that they're going to privatize the medical care. I happen to be a veteran, and I attend the veterans hospital. I was there yesterday. One of the reasons why, if you read the New York Times yesterday, the largest VA in the nation, the LA VA in Los Angeles, California, the Salvation Army, a private organization, was running a program for veterans, and five died in a period of time. So that's not the answer.
Yeah. I agree with you. Privatization would be a disaster, and that's Larry's point. It's my point. Every time the government has tried to privatize something, whether it was privatizing Katrina to Pat Robertson's Operation Blessing, or whether it's privatizing Iraq to all of the contractors that are over there, we got 100,000 people, Americans over there working as our mercenary arm. It's been a disaster.
Yeah. And also another reason why it won't be privatized, because one of the reasons why you had the Walter Reed controversy and disaster is because the VA and the service from whence the veterans come from, they didn't use a computer model to coordinate their records. So if you privatize it, that's going to have the records spread all over the place.
It'll simply become another commodity, another thing that you can buy and sell. Absolutely spot on, Ted. Well said. Alex in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, Alex, welcome to the program.
Good morning. I was bringing something up earlier when I was on Malloy and the other guy. Anyways, we got this thing going on here in Arizona where we got these vigilantes that are shooting illegal immigrants as they come over.
You're right.
And we've also got...
This is where the whole thing gets into the area of just absolute hysteria. I get these guys on the program, and they go, oh, there's all these illegals coming. And I say, and we're going to protest. And I say, why don't you protest outside the employer's office? Why don't you talk about putting CEOs in jail? Oh, we can't put CEOs in jail. We couldn't do that. Are you kidding?
Well, you know, they've also got the small mom-and-pop operations, and I can't blame these people. You know, this is a right-to-work state. Our gas just hit $2.81. There are people barely making their mortgage payments and paying their utilities.
Right, and we should have an underlying structure in the United States where you have, you know, strong minimum wage laws, you have strong unionization, rebuild the middle class. Let's change our trade laws so that we bring the jobs back into the state, into our states and into the United States, and rebuild our industrial infrastructure, and then you're not going to have people who are saying, oh, the only way we can survive is by getting people who are willing to work for $2 or $3 an hour.
Well, see, the other thing is a lot of these people that are working here aren't working for less than what they would pay white people. Okay, because a lot of the white people just won't work. If they don't get $20 an hour, they're not going to work.
Well, maybe $20
an hour. And I talked to a lot of these employers and these people, you know, that use this. I mean, it's a right-to-work state.
First of all, Alex, it's not an issue about brown people or white people, because you've got very, very large unemployed American citizen populations in the United States. Frankly, the largest percentage of people living in poverty in the United States are white and are willing to work. And you've got a very large African American populations as well. You've got a large Hispanic U.S. citizen populations who are living in poverty. Yeah, no, that's the bottom line. That's the bottom line. And I just don't buy it that people are unwilling to work. I'm sorry. People are not willing to work for the pay that's being offered. That's the market. And so, you know, what we have to do is say, offer reasonable pay. Bob in Westchester, New York. Hey, Bob.
Yep. I hope your caller previous, Ted, was correct that there's no chance of privatizing the veterans' health care system. However, I would like to point out about the Shalala Commission that Donna Shalala sits on the board of directors of United Healthcare, a company that is best known for its president having one of the biggest...
William McGuire, $1.78 billion paycheck.
Correct. And of course, the Dole family is very closely connected with the Red Cross, which has had its own experiences with trying to raise funds with false advertising.
Yeah, Elizabeth Dole was the CEO, pulling a multi-hundred-thousand-dollar paycheck in the process, and scandals swirling thereabouts. Yeah, good point, Bob. Thank you very much for raising it. I agree that we should be very, very concerned about this. Cynthia in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Cynthia.
Hey, Tom. I'm just very happy that ABC network coverage has finally caught up to your program standards. When I'm speaking of the Nightline episode last night on Iran, I was stunned to see it.
The amazing thing is that it's not a screaming headline in all the major newspapers in America, and it's not at the top of every newscast in America. I heard it on ABC News at 4 o'clock this morning here on KPOJ, where I broadcast from, because before we start, you know, doing live programming, we run the ABC Network News, and then the rest of the day it's Air America News. You know, I heard the ABC report, and I was like, whoa, that's ABC talking like that? But none of the other networks seem to be picking this thing up.
Well, they need to, but, you know, with the release of the soldiers in Iran, you know, and I've been watching the networks today to see how they played this. It was they're kind of gloomy. And they're saying Iran blinked when in fact the British apparently released that one person that you mentioned who was abducted a month ago. So the adults are in charge of the association.
Yeah. No, it's good point, Cynthia. And let's hope.
One other thing. You mentioned they're not going to use the war on terror anymore. Brzezinski and the people around him are in charge again, thank goodness. A couple of weeks ago, he wrote an article about the war on terror is not working. So rational people are taking control again, thank God.
Hopefully. And thank you, Cynthia. Although, you know, reading Brzezinski's The Grand Chess Game, I have some questions, some doubts about him as well. Amy in San Diego, California. Hey, Amy.
Hey, Tom, it's great to talk to you again. And last week I heard you talking about why after a president appoints someone like a U.S. attorney, that they can't just fire them willy-nilly. And I was wondering, I didn't get to hear all of what you were saying. Could you explain it again? Why can't they just fire people that they have appointed?
Well, they can. This is what Madison was arguing back in 1789, I think it was, or 91, whatever the year was. I think it was 1789 in the first session of Congress, was when they were trying to come up with a list of things that you could impeach a president for, and they were trying to decide, they were trying to create the Secretary of the Department of State. And this was the first year of the George Washington administration. And what Madison was saying is that a president would, although presidents have to appoint people like federal prosecutors, they have to be confirmed by the Senate. And because it's subject to senatorial confirmation, the executive branch would not arbitrarily dismiss good people or not do it for political purposes, because that would come out during the Senate confirmation of the replacer or the successor. And what happened is that by slipping this thing into the Patriot Act, Arlen Specter had this right-wing guy on his staff who slipped this thing into the Patriot Act that said the Senate no longer has to approve these people. And so, you know, 230 years of U.S. law got changed. The Constitution got changed. The guy who slipped it in is now a federal prosecutor. Surprise, surprise. It's just totally weird. But the protection is that the Senate has to confirm it, Amy. And that's the bottom line. And hopefully we're going to be back to that soon, because the Senate has voted to change that law. Now the House needs to get to work on it. Rob in Long Island, New York. Hey, Rob.
Hi, Tom. How you doing? Wait, Tom, I disagree with that call you had a couple minutes ago. That it's completely just a foul.
I mean, the guy who said white people don't want to work.
Exactly.
It was an incorrect economic assumption, and B, in my opinion, a fundamentally racist statement.
Well, the thing is that I lived for about 6 months in Pittsburgh. I live in New York, but for about 6 months I lived in Pittsburgh. And in New York, you may see an immigrant pumping your gas, you know, a recent person who just moved here from another country taking a minimum wage job. That's true. But in Pittsburgh, where I was living, you know, the people who were working at the convenience stores and the people who were pumping your gas and mowing your lawn were all white. There's not a massive immigrant population in Pittsburgh, you know, stealing white jobs because white people are too lazy to do the job.
This rhetoric, this language. Is the exact language that was used against Italians when they came here by the WASPs who were already here, and then it was used by Italians against the Irish Catholics and on it goes. I mean, this is just simply the history of minority groups in the United States. And the kind of trashing of them that goes on. That said, it is reasonable to have a reasonable immigration policy.
You know, something that's interesting is that one of the editorial staff from Telemundo was on Bill Maher about a year ago, and he made mention of the fact that why would a Mexican do a job, you know, for $8 a week when they can come over here and do it for $8 an hour? If they're doing it for $8 an hour, that's certainly not them working below minimum wage. They're doing it because of the fact that they can make more money. You know, so even that argument that they're coming over to take jobs that white people won't do, you know, that's a fallacy as well, because you're not paying these guys $2 an hour, you're paying them minimum wage.
Right. Yeah, and that's my point, is that you're not paying to the market. And this is what David Ricardo said in 1816 in his treatise on labor, is that the price of labor in the marketplace is nothing more or less than a function of the availability of labor. And that if the availability of labor exceeds demand for labor, that the price of labor will drop to what Ricardo referred to as a subsistence level. He calls this his iron law of wages. In other words, everybody will be the working poor when there's a surplus of labor. And that's why the history of the progressive movement, going back to the mid-1800s, has been to try to limit the supply of labor through child labor laws, through unionization, where the unions have control over the, and this actually goes back to the 1700s, to the Masons, the Masonic, the early guilds. I mean, they were all union attempts to limit labor. If you can limit the supply of labor, and again, that's why you have immigration laws, to equal the demand for labor, then labor can stand up and say, hey, wait a minute, we're going to have a union, we're going to demand decent wages. But if you have a surplus of labor, then that will drive down the price of labor. And so when you see these situations where people are you know, like you're describing, it's simply that, the imbalance between the supply and the demand of labor. 45 minutes past the hour. Your calls, more of your calls next.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Indeed, Go-Go Gonzalez, helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Rick in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Rick.
Hey, how you doing?
Just great. What's up?
Hey, I ultimately would like to say something about that Ayn Rand guy you had on the previous hour.
Yaron Brook was his name.
Yeah. Well, but you had an interview just moments ago about the guy talking about the government is running out of money, so they now have to privatize the health care for the veterans.
Well, it's not that they claim that they're running out of money. They believe this religion that private corporations can always do things better than government, and it's demonstrably and patently false. There are many things that private industry does better than government. I don't want government building my TV set or making my shoes or my computer, thank you very much. But when it comes to administering the commons, there is a long history of government doing a better job than the private sector.
Right, and then he said that I guess the politician he was talking to had responded by saying that there just wasn't enough money.
Oh, It may well be.
I was just going to confirm that actually privatization normally doesn't work at all for the commons.
Now, right. and it also costs more money. I mean, you know, look at education, great example. If they're going to give out vouchers for health care, and I mean, you look at the example of the Veterans Administration, which is arguably socialized medicine, or Medicare, which is single payer health care. Both of them operate at around between a 2% and 4% overhead. You've got private health care in this United States, for-profit health care, that has to have at least a 5, 6, 8, 10% margin on the top to be able to pay dividends to stockholders. On top of that, you got to pay CEO salaries. On top of that, you got the fancy corporate headquarters. You got advertising. You got marketing. You got the corporate jets. You got, you know, you add it all together. And then on top of that, they have to deliver services. And let's say they can more efficiently deliver services by 25%. So they're delivering services at 3%, but then you load another 15 or 20% on that, and you get to the actual cost of delivering health care with a for-profit system in the United States, which when you actually look at it is between 20 and 30% overhead.
Well, I get that. I'm just trying to figure out why can't politicians try to put it two to two together and realize that Bush has borrowed more than all presidents combined, and then can say and not say that they can't figure out why there isn't enough money.
Yeah, well, there's a real easy answer to that, Rick, and that is that the private health insurance companies, in the case of health care, the private health insurance companies and the special interests, the large multinational corporations that profit off government privatizing things from Katrina to Iraq to our veterans' health care
are the ones who
are stuffing dollars into our politicians' pockets so fast that they don't know what to do with them. Good point, though. Rick, thanks for the call. Craig in Seattle. Hey, Craig, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom, I just had a question on Brzezinski
about.
Was he not with the Carter administration, and he was the one that started the Trilateral Commission? Which
he did
really
not start the Trilateral Commission. No, the Trilateral Commission's been around for a long time. I believe it goes back to the 50s. I may be wrong on that, but I think the Council on Foreign Relations. Actually, I'm not sure.
Because I know he had something to do with the Carter administration, and he actually predated...
Yeah, he was a national security advisor. Yeah, he was to the Carter administration what Condi Rice was to the first Bush, you know, the first four years of the Bush administration.
Yeah, and a lot of the things that he helped set up were actually what set us on this path of privatization and going down the road of selling out industry in this country.
No, handing over to industry our national defense. No, I'm not disagreeing with you, Craig, and that's why I said I have, you know, Zbigniew Brzezinski is a very, very astute observer of world events, and I don't share his worldview of what our position should be in the world. I think that, if anything, we should be promoting peace. Steve in Maywood, New Jersey. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Tom. Great show.
I'm
going to go off subject a little bit, but I've been a Marine for about 6 years, honorable discharge. Not quite the pacifist I'd like to be, but don't you think that the most important legislative issue right now in the House is H.R. 808, the establishment of peace and nonviolent department? I mean, it seems like the attempt to establish a cabinet-level Department of Peace would act as such a balancing point to our Department of Defense. I'm not satisfied with the domestic violence we have in our country or the international violence. And again, I said I'm not a pacifist. I still think there's room for surgical bombings and absolute, you know, trajectory and missiles that can do much better, more precise bombings. But I'm not.
There's room for self-defense. Steve, I am supportive of the creation of a Department of Peace. I don't personally think that it's the most important piece of legislation, but I think it's an important piece of legislation. And yeah, I absolutely support it.
But, you know, I just think that if we got all the information we needed, the facts are in, the
bottom line is, though,
in.
That I don't think it's going to happen because you've got a huge industry out there. You know, we spend more on defense than every other country in the world combined.
Well, you know,
and that's mind-boggling.
Well, the Department of Defense is, or Department of Peace, the DOP, is asking for 2% of the DOD budget, which is like $8 billion. We'll set up a peace academy. I mean, we have three military academies that teach kids how to do war. But we're peace illiterate in our country. We don't have an academy that'll teach people how to mediate, to reduce tension. And
I think it's a great idea, Steve. I think it's a great idea, and I totally support it. And I'm doubtful it'll happen, tragically, but I agree with you. I mean, out of every federal dollar in taxes, about half of it is going to defense. You got 2 cents going to education, 8 cents going to pay off the debt that Reagan and Bush ran up. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman program on Air America Radio, I'll be debating Paul Cameron, who says gays shouldn't adopt because of a study he says shows gays die at a younger age. I'll be taking him and his study apart piece by piece. Danny O'Brien with the Electronic Freedom Frontier Foundation is here about the problem of web censorship, and always the best of the news and your calls. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.